no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.
The Fed's out of options. Rate cuts, money printing, balance sheet reversals. They call it policy, but it's really panic. This is in-game economics, where hope replaces discipline and the illusion of control finally breaks. They're not cutting rates because things are strong. They're cutting because the system is cracking. Inflation's eating savings. The labor market's stalling. Confidence in the dollar is fading fast. For decades, the Fed built a house of paper. Now they're striking the match that could burn it all down, leaving you to pay the price. When's the last time you actually held the wealth you've spent your life working for? My friends at Noble Gold Investments have been helping Americans move from paper wealth into real tangible assets. Numbers on a screen can disappear, but physical gold and silver, they've outlasted every crisis in history. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and get your free wealth protection kit today. That's NobleGoldInvestments.com for your free wealth protection kit. Discover how simple it is to protect your future.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi, I'm Michael Isikoff, and this is Spy Talk.
It is one of the most daring and devastating Ukrainian attacks on Russian troops since the start of the war. Tonight, President Zelensky said his forces used 117 drones in strikes on Russian air bases from deep inside Russia itself, targeting warplanes, including strategic bombers.
That's a BBC account of one of the more remarkable intelligence operations in modern times, one every bit as audacious and successful as last year's exploding pagers targeting Hezbollah fighters by the Israeli Mossad. For more than a year and a half, Ukraine's intelligence service had been plotting this strike, smuggling drones concealed in trucks into Russia, carefully positioning them and then releasing them simultaneously to destroy dozens of nuclear-capable bombers throughout the country, even some on an airbase in Siberia. How are the Ukrainians able to pull this off? And what does it mean for the future of a conflict that, contrary to President Trump's campaign promise to end the whole thing in 24 hours, seems to be raging on and even escalating with no peace deal in sight? We'll talk to Senator Mark Warner, a Democrat from Virginia and the ranking member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, about this and much else, including his mounting concerns about the politicization of U.S. intelligence agencies, on this episode of Spy Talk. Senator Mark Warner, welcome to Spy Talk.
Hey, Michael, thank you so much for having me.
Well, we've been eager to get you on for some time. You are, of course, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, and we have a lot of questions about what's been going on with the committee and what kind of oversight you're doing. But let's start out with this extraordinary covert op intelligence operation that the Ukrainians pulled off over the weekend, smuggling drones on trucks into Russia and then launching drone attacks, taking out aircraft all over the giant Russian nation, including in Siberia. What did you make of this attack just as an intel operation, and what's it going to mean for the future of that conflict?
Well, first of all, it was remarkable. It shows how scrappy the Ukrainians are. I like to point back to the fact that this is about 6 months old data that, you know, Ukraine, our assistance, without the single loss of an American and a NATO soldier, had taken out 87% of Russia's pre-existing ground forces, 63% of their tanks, 30-odd% of their armored personnel carriers. Mm-hmm. And they did it on their own. And obviously on the ground, Putin has been grinding it out, although, again, not at the level that I was concerned about a number of months ago. But the idea that the Ukrainians were able to, one, construct these trucks and other entities where they could load in the drones, get them into Russia. And, you know, and I read one where that the air base in Siberia was literally 3,800 miles away from the Ukrainian border. That's holy heck. Yeah. And launch these on a simultaneous basis. And then, and at least to my early understanding, have a number of these trucks then destruct. So the Russians weren't able to learn how they did it. It is one, remarkable. Two, it, you know, it's the closest thing since would be probably the IDF's exploding pagers against Hezbollah. Right. I would also add that the subsequent attack in the last couple of days with, in effect, underwater drones on the Kerch Bridge to Crimea is kind of been a 1-2 punch. And I think it shows that, one, that, you know, you shouldn't count Ukrainians out. Two, that, you know, it's one more argument why we and, you know, those countries who we always be traditionally view as our allies need to do more to continue to help the Ukrainians. And then three, and this is probably, you know, we could spend a whole hour just on this conversation. It is one more piece of evidence that traditional warfare, you know, who has the most tanks, guns, ships, and planes may not necessarily be a victor in one of these conflicts. The fact that Ukraine has, as creating these drones, you know, literally the cost of a couple $100s each, and my understanding has kind of ramped up their domestic production from 2 million to where they hope to even, you know, over the next year get to 4 million. It's jaw-dropping.
So as you, I'm sure, know, President Trump spoke today, Thursday, with President Putin, who made clear, according to Trump's posting since the call ended, that he's going to respond and that there's no imminent peace deal in the offing. And Keith Kellogg, who is Trump's Ukraine envoy, just said in an interview that the war in Ukraine was going way up. I'm telling you, the risk levels are going way up. Do you anticipate how do you anticipate what the Russians will do? And look, it's been on the table all along. Is there a threat of this going nuclear?
Well, first of all, there always remains a threat. And, you know, Putin is a bully. Putin can't be trusted. I think he continues to be concerned about, you know, NATO weighing in entirely, although when we continue to have a president to distance himself between us and NATO, I think that doesn't help America's national defense. So I'm not surprised that you're going to see, you know, Putin strike back. I mean, this is a huge embarrassment to the Russian military. I know, you know, Russian bloggers have called it the equivalent of their Pearl Harbor. That's, you know, pretty strong words. And yet you don't hear is that, you know, in the days and weeks leading up to this attack, you know, Russia has been literally plummeting Ukraine and disproportionately not even bothering to try to target military installations and target civilian installations, you know, putting civilians at risk. So I'm not surprised that Putin is going to hit back. Is there, we all hope there would not be further escalation. I think the best way we could prevent further escalation is for the United States to go ahead and continue to arm along with our NATO and other allies around the world, the Ukrainians, particularly on air defenses. And that would force Putin to a serious peace conversation, as opposed to what he's been doing now is, you know, these kind of fake meetings that just, you know, extend the conflict, I think, with the presumption that he could ultimately grind down the Ukrainian forces. This kind of both attack on the airfields and on the bridge shows that Ukraine's still got a few tricks up its sleeves.
Is Trump being played by Putin?
I think anybody that trusts Vladimir Putin, and I, you know, part of that same post said suddenly Vladimir Putin was going to intervene in the Iran negotiations. Mm-hmm. I would never trust Vladimir Putin. I think he's had a long history of not keeping his word. And this so-called special relationship between Trump and Putin is more than a little bizarre. And yeah, I worry that Putin has been playing Trump to basically string along with the Russian expectation that they would, you know, pick up more ground in the conflict in Ukraine.
So, look, I mean, a number of your colleagues, including Republicans like Senator Graham, have been backing legislation to impose even much harsher sanctions on the Russians going after their oil trade in particular. I assume you're on board with that, but are we closer to having that happen? And can you see Trump actually pulling the trigger on that?
Michael, you know, I think we're up to like 82 co-sponsors.
Yeah.
You know, so the fact that that's even a bigger number on a percentage basis than who voted for Ukraine aid, a year or so back. I wish, you know, Leader Thune would bring the bill to the floor. I know that might delay the big ugly bill that they're working on, but you know, the overwhelming majority of the U.S. Senate wants us to do this, and you know, and literally, the tariffs are pretty draconian. Mm-hmm. At 500%, but you know, since we've already seen, you know, the Trump taco policy of, you know, threatening and then pulling back time and again on tariffs, I think it'd be an important statement. I think it would also be an important statement, you know, to, and I'm chair of the India caucus, for example, but you know, putting a price on continuing to buy Russian oil, I think would send a signal that we're going to stand by democracies against autocratic nations, whether they be Russia or Iran or China or elsewhere.
One more beat on spiderweb, because there's been a lot of commentary in the last day or so about what this operation shows about potential vulnerabilities that we might have from, you know, the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians doing something similar against us. And just to add some, a point on that, you know, sneaking in drones into the country is probably not all that difficult. I mean, for years, there's been questions about inspections on container ships that come into U.S. ports and whether they could contain something nasty such as this. I mean, are there steps U.S. security officials have to take now to prevent something like this not happening to us?
I think we're going to have a bit of a wake-up call. And I do know, and I don't know the answer, I do know a senior former national security official who had worked for both Democrats and Republicans literally sent me a day or so ago just Google Earth photos mm-hmm. of a number of our military bases where, you know, our planes are neatly lined up in a row. What we do about that, you know, I don't know yet, you know, and in terms of disbursement or others, we're asking both, you know, Air Force and others on recommendations. I do think I've got bipartisan legislation, for example, with Rick Scott for some time to try to cut back on, you know, the Chinese drone maker DJI that, you know, basically already dominates about 90% of the, you know, enthusiasts drone markets. It's also used by law enforcement. I think we need to wean ourselves off of those Chinese entities, more because of the concerns that they might have, you know, embedded software, frankly, if you have at some point any kind of update. And most of these drones don't have an update the way a Huawei would. But, you know, I think there's problems there. But I do think it kind of, it begs the bigger question that our constant investment in legacy systems and who has, again, the most tanks, guns, ships, and planes. And I know this is a little bit of a heresy to say, but I'm not sure that necessarily means in modern conflict, you're going to be successful. The power of unmanned systems playing out real time is mind-boggling to me. And I still hear, you know, whether it's from the Intel side, or I've got obviously a lot of DoD contractors in Virginia, but when I still hear some of our American entities come in and say, oh, Senator, I got great news. We brought our drone price down to about $18,000 per unit. Well, you know, that obviously would carry a bigger payload, but if you're seeing these couple hundred dollar drones that can be produced by Ukraine in the millions, how we rethink a strategy that's based on that, and then also how we rethink the notion of, you know, the ability to smuggle in, you know, these very small and flexible items. I mean, that's a big problem. Maybe a few more folks on the border looking at that, rather than having, you know, ICE agents in totally masked and covered grabbing, you know, families off the street. Might be a better allocation of resources.
I look forward to questioning Tom Homan about that when he comes before the Senate next. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk to Senator Warner about an issue he's very concerned about, and that is the politicization of U.S. intelligence agencies. And now we are back with Senator Warner. We have spent a lot of time here at Spy Talk writing and talking about some of the revelations about how the U.S. intelligence agencies, in particular ODNI, have politicized the intelligence process, most prominently in the question of Venezuela, the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua, and the extent to which it may or may not be sponsored by the Venezuelan government. The National Intelligence Council said it was not, and that the evidence to support that was simply not there. That contradicted what President Trump had said. Tulsi Gabbard fires the two heads of the National Intelligence Council after they disputed what was said, and her chief of staff that's after the chief of staff, Joe Kent, directed them to change their analysis. That seems like a cardinal sin in the intelligence world. Give me your take on this and what you want to see done about it.
Well, Michael, you took the words right out of my mouth. I mean, like, you've got a great way up here. I mean, like, remember, and you've reported and covered the espionage arena for a long, long time. And, you know, the one thing I think we learned, you know, starting with the beginning of Intel oversight after the Church hearings, then after the Iraq War, that, you know, we got to have an intelligence community that speaks truth to power and not politicized. And the hypocrisy of Tulsi Gabbard, who in her hearing said, oh, you know, I've seen the politicization of what happens. It costs people's lives, literally citing the Iraq circumstance, although I would also remind you that this was the same Tulsi Gabbard that would not call Edward Snowden a traitor. And it was why I would voted clearly against her and tried to urge my Republican colleagues. And so many of them said, Mark, I'm, you know, I get it. But on top of that, you then have had Ms. Gabbard on probably more right-wing media combined than the previous three or four ODNIs put together, including ODNIs under the first Trump administration. And then you've got this circumstance, which you've just, you have completely laid out. You get a national intelligence estimate that comes back that, and Tren de Aragua, let me make sure, the Venezuelan gang, they're bad guys, they're bad folks, but the question was, are they actually controlled by the Maduro government in Venezuela? And they said, they're bad guys, but there is the intelligence, does not mean there is a direct control. And as opposed to then that truth being spoken to power, this Tulsi Gabbard's chief of staff, who she tried to promote into another position, and then we got emails saying, well, you know, we don't want to embarrass, we want to have anything out here that would embarrass the president of the United States. Well, that is classic political interference.
Okay, so what do you do about it? This is the kind of thing that in years past would be the subject of hearings before the Oversight Committee. You're the ranking Democrat on the committee. I mean, have you spoken to the chairman, Tom Cotton, about holding a hearing on this, about digging in further?
Michael, yes, but let me lead up to that answer.
Okay.
One of the things that I'm so proud of is, you know, when Richard Burr was chair and I was vice chair, we took on the whole Russia investigation. It was unanimous. It was bipartisan. When I was chair and Marco Rubio was vice chair, we did a host of things in a bipartisan fashion, including calling out the Biden administration for their dreadful withdrawal from Afghanistan. I have raised this issue, and so far the chairman has not moved forward. I'm still trying to work on it. I've had a lot of my Republican colleagues say to me, "Oh, Mark, you know," because I'm not trying to publicly embarrass. I'm raising this in the skiff in where we hold our sessions. Mm-hmm. I think it's inexcusable. I think that Gabbard should resign. I think that, you know, Joe Kent, who's up for a position, should not be put forward.
Has he been voted on by the committee, by the way, to be head of NCTC?
I can't recall whether he's not been voted on the floor, and I can't. Yeah. He may have been voted on the committee, obviously, and all the Democrats right. voted against him.
Right.
But it's, you know, this is a pattern. This is a pattern that we see with, you know, this political interference. And I can tell you, Michael, I've talked to Five Eyes partners who knew these intelligence professionals who got fired for doing their job. They're frankly astonished. And I do believe that we will see a lack of sharing of information with this type of activity. And if this was a single incident, mm-hmm. you know, it would still be inexcusable. But remember, this builds upon the Signalgate conversations where the DNI was abroad and, you know, it was too inconvenient to get to a skiff or get to our own aircraft and have that classified conversation about, you know, the potential attacks on the Houthis in a way that we protect. I've urged Gabbard or Hegseth to come down to Norfolk, Virginia, where the USS Truman is home ported, and explain to the friends and families on that of the Truman how, if that information had got out, how that wouldn't have put their loved ones, the sailors, at risk. They've obviously not taken up. But we have seen this careless approach on classification. We've now seen this political interference. I think I've got a lot of my Republican colleagues who are privately expressing concern to me. But
has any of them said anything publicly?
There have been a few comments, not to the point of what I would like to see.
Right. Wicker has said on Signalgate he wanted that investigated, and I think he brought it to the attention of the DOD IG. But what does Cotton say when you raise it with him? I mean,
I'm going to leave. Cotton and I have a working relationship. I'm going to leave my conversations with him private, and I am, you know, not giving up on doing everything I damn well can to try to maintain the fact that the Senate Intelligence Committee is the last fully functioning bipartisan committee in the Congress. That has been our reputation under both Democrats or Republicans, and I'm going to keep working like hell to maintain that. But I got some more work to do.
Are you at all confident or optimistic you're going to be able to get some hearings?
I'm going to keep pressing the case. Let me even go back a little bit further. You know, yeah. I think there's been a private communication, but there's not even been a public acknowledgement, for example, that all the devices that were used in Signalgate, this is not even on the trend to Agua, but even the devices that were used in Signalgate, have they been checked for malware?
Yeah.
You know, that seems like it's a pretty, you know, mm-hmm. Intel 101 kind of question. I think there's been a private communication asking that question. But I've seen no public. I've gotten no public response, for example, to that question. And so far, you know, if the administration still puts forward Mr. Kent's nomination, you will hear from me on the floor of the Senate, and you know, we can cite chapter and verse about why this guy should not be promoted for trying to interfere in a intelligence product that, again, resulted in, you know, long-term career officials being fired. But I guess we shouldn't be totally shocked, since, you know, if we think about over our friends at the NSA and Cybercom, the fact that, you know, General Hawk got fired. Tim Hawk got fired after, 30 years of service because some crazy right-wing extremist, Laura Loomer, came into the White House and put him on some hit list. This has never happened before. I mean, when you're talking off air, I disagreed in a lot of ways, obviously, with most things Trump did and Trump won. But I found people I could work with. It is dramatically different now. And the barriers and boundaries that certain things, like the maintenance of classification levels and keeping intelligence secret and being careful, it feels like a lot of those rules that worked the first round are sure as heck not being observed this second round.
One news item today that I want to ask you about on a different subject, and that is the intelligence threat from China. So today, two Chinese nationals are accused of smuggling a potential agro-terrorism weapon, a noxious fungus, into the U.S. The two Chinese nationals were charged in a criminal complaint with conspiracy smuggling goods. One of them worked at the University of Michigan. The other worked at a Chinese university. Just last week, Secretary Rubio announced this new program to revoke student visas for Chinese students coming to the United States if they have any ties to the Communist Party or work in critical areas. Does this arrest today support the idea of what Rubio is doing?
Well, first of all, I just heard about this arrest, as I was coming in to do this podcast. Right. And, so I want to get information.
Right.
But I am the first to acknowledge that, China poses an existential threat. They are a great nation. We've never had a technology competitor in particular that is at this level. Mm-hmm. And, starting back when Burr and I, back in 2017, we started holding what we called classified roadshows, where we took industry sector after industry sector and gave them a brief on the threats coming from China. And I got to tell you, we brought in all the universities. And that first meeting was pretty frosty. And at that point, there were 360,000 Chinese students all paying full tuition at American universities and great students. So having a better vetting process absolutely makes sense. But when we, and this is a tough one, and 80% of the Chinese graduate students in STEM fields choose to stay in America. Mm-hmm. And I can point you to not dozens, but literally hundreds of tech companies where Chinese Americans have done great work here. But there was also recognizing, particularly with the Confucius Institutes for years, they had these entities on college and universities that literally were outposts for the Chinese spy services, where students were monitored. And I do think there were a number of times where students were literally, their family back in China was threatened if they didn't come home with a thumb drive. So I am in favor of increased scrutiny, but the notion, if there are direct proven ties to a CCP operation, I am against issuing those visas, but not something that is suddenly going to blanket, anyone that comes from China with the presumption that they're a spy. And this is also the case as we see, candidly, university after university get attacked for having international students beyond those that are Chinese nationals. So there is a problem. There have been universities been penetrated. We got to up our game. But and I would agree, if you've got a tie to the CCP, that you shouldn't be granted a visa. But there's a whole lot of folks that don't fall in that category.
Well, Senator Warner, I want to thank you. There's much more we could talk to you about, but I know you've got a heart out. But I particularly want to say we definitely want to stay in touch on the question of politicization of intelligence and whether you make any progress in getting some real oversight on this question.
And I appreciate, and I think you ought to hold all of our feet to the fire. Yeah. Everyone, we need the press sometimes drives us crazy, but we need you guys to make sure, particularly in this domain, that we are held accountable and that we don't allow that politicization that, again, Tulsi Gabbard spoke to in our hearing and now has done absolutely nothing to prevent in her time as DNI.
Understood. Thank you, Senator Warner.
Thank you.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyal from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.